This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and a warm welcome to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. I'm Mark Stephen.
And I'm Ewan McElraith. And this week, I've been up in Glen Tanner hearing about, well, a pretty scary big turkey of the woods.
And I've been up wondering about the Angus Glens with one of the keepers up there who's doing wildlife safaris. His name is Andy Malcolm. He has been up there for about, I don't know, the guts of 30 years, there or thereabouts.
Does he have music playing on? Hey, yep.
No, he doesn't have any of that.
Would add a whole dimension to it.
Yeah, he would. I will grant you that. But we actually started off, there is a community-run museum and tea shop in the Glen, which is called The Retreat. We started off and actually says, look, we'll take some grub with us and they're going to sort us out a picnic. Norma Lyle from The Retreat did a cracking job.
We try to use as many local suppliers as possible to give a quality feel to the picnic and also to support them. So we have a Bouvrage raspberry juice that's produced just outside Brechin, really nice zingy flavour. Then we've got Duncan of Deeside's oat cakes and, of course, home bacon. Can't go wrong with that.
No,
and we
exactly.
try to cater for different dietary requirements. So you've got in there today a gluten-free fruit cake and some lemon drizzle cake. Moving over this way, we've got Sacred Grounds coffee beans. They're a company from Arbroath, not too far away. And then we've got a nice hunky sandwich here. This is ketchup.
Ah, that's what I like to see. Yeah, a man's sandwich.
Piece, yes.
No messing about.
No messing about. So that's GI bread from Kepti Bakery in Arbroath. And on there, Chris, our chef, has put some home-baked ham, cheese and tomato, quite a traditional filling.
Fine.
So, yeah, that's what we're trying to do, just to give a quality offering.
It's a really nice idea. And if you're coming out into the Angus Glens, etc., taking a trip out with somebody, you know, getting the full flavour of the countryside, it makes sense to get the full flavour of the food at the same time.
Yeah, and what we're also trying to do is, you know, make the connection with the land and the community as well. I mean, oat cakes would have been a very traditional thing that would have been made, and, you know, we've got the old girdles here, the old things for turning the oat cakes. So it's moving towards connecting people with the landscape that they're out in, you know, to understand where their food's coming from as well, and telling the story of the traditional crafts and so on too. So it all ties in together with what we're trying to do here.
And well, that's us got the picnic, and this is us in the Land Rover now with gamekeeper and part-time tour guide, Andy Malcolm. We picked the right day for it,
haven't we just? The forecast was good as well.
Yeah, and it's not.
No, it's not. The mist is right down on the hills. We've got a fine drizzle covering everything. And one of the big problems today is going to be that there's so much meltwater coming down the rivers, it's going to be very difficult finding any river we can actually get this rover across.
Crack on then, let's go. The gearbox on this thing seems to be a bit of a soup dragon.
It's a bit like...
Just rub a lot around and we'll find a gear in a minute.
It's a bit like stirring a bucket of nails. That's Land Rover's character, they call it.
Yep.
There's an old nest in a tree back there, and this is the time of year that gamekeepers, we walk all our trees looking for crow's nests. And you have to time it right. If you do it too soon, the crows come in behind you and nest in trees that you think are checked. If you leave it too late, the trees come out into bud and then into leaf, and you can't see them. So it's getting this happy medium.
Okay, once you know that there's a crow's nest there, what do you do about it?
Well, ideally, you go and you shoot the hen off the nest. which is far easier said than done. Your modern alternative is to put a crow trap, a cage down. This is a decoy bird, and you introduce this decoy bird into...
A Larson trap, basically.
That's right. You put it into these crows' territory, and they sort of go and try and see it off, get caught unharmed in the trap. Or you try and shoot the hen off the nest. The problem being that these crows, they're not daft, and they tend to choose trees. Quite often it's a single tree out by itself on a hillside, and they can see you approaching from miles in every direction. Furthermore, they can count as well. Say you have a hide, you've resorted to putting a hide out to try and sort of get your crow. If you walk to that hide, the crow will just see you going to the hide and won't go anywhere near. If two of you go to the hide and one stays in the hide, the crow still won't come near. It needs three of you, they can't count to three. You're starting to talk about a considerable sort of input of man hours just to get a man in a hide in the off chance of shooting this crow. But to put it all in perspective, you think a crow is just a crow, but a crow can do an amazing amount of harm.
In what way?
Well, crows will take eggs. Everybody knows crows take eggs. They can also sort of take the eyes out of young lambs. The other thing that they'll do is they don't just stop with the eggs, you know, with young chicks as well. You know, sort of a crow is a pretty voracious predator. They'll take eggs, they'll take chicks. And yes, we're trying to protect our grouse, but, you know, they're not discerning. They'll take anything. And I've heard reports of crows taking harrier's eggs and rare species like that. Right. Okay, I've stopped here because I was going to be taking you up onto this face beyond the wood here. You can see coming down out of the mist, you can see this green stripe coming down the hill. Uh-huh. And where that green stripe stops, at the top of a face of rocks, there's a deep cleft in the rock. And in there is a silver mine. Going back to the 1600s, and the then Laird brought in a German prospector. Basically, he wanted to know sort of what resources he had here. So this prospector went out and he found silver here and at the back of Tarfside. But this mine here, well, it was obviously worth exploiting. At the back of the wood here, I've come across an old ruin. It's like a button bend. It's just an oblong mound, but it's too big to be a button bend. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if this is where the miners were housed. Yeah. But when you go to the mine itself, it's right at the top of this really inaccessible outcrop of rock. Just to get to it, you're taking your life in your hands.
You're really selling this to
me.
Oh,
yeah, Martin. Yeah. Well, I was going to take you up there. There's actually the stream, I think, must have been diverted. Uh-huh. And it's resorted back to its original course, which means it's all flooded now. And you actually have to walk through a waterfall to get into the entrance of the mine. And after that, you can see there's just a flooded hole in the ground.
Uh-huh. Is there any record of how rich it was?
Yes, there is. Uh-huh. Yeah. I always think this is great PR. They call it a silver mine, but what it was lead that yielded 1/54th part silver.
1/54th.
Yeah, okay. And that warrants calling it a silver mine.
Well, I don't know whether that's good, bad or indifferent. I have no idea.
No.
Gamekeeper Andy Malcolm, and earlier we heard from Norman Lyle. I think honesty is the best policy. If we don't know something, we just say we don't know something, and usually somebody contacts and tells us.
I was more excited about the picnic in a wicker basket.
It's very good.
It tastes better than a wicker basket.
Well, the idea of going out on a wildlife safari with a keeper, because you're looking at it from a different perspective. I mean, they have a job of work to do in the countryside that is fairly clearly delineated by the needs of a sporting estate. Now, you may disagree with that totally, but it's very interesting to get that perspective.
Yeah. Did you have a Scotch egg?
No, I had no Scotch egg.
That's a real pity, because it could have... You know, Scotch eggs were invented by Thomas Cook?
I did not know that.
For their train expeditions. Right. Excursions was the word I was looking for.
For those of you, this will mean nothing to the vast majority of people out with Scotland. A Scotch egg is basically a boiled egg surrounded by sort of like luncheon meat, and then it's got rusk on the outside.
Yeah, something like sausage
meat. Or breadcrumbs.
Sausage
meat and breadcrumbs.
And then baked in the oven. Try it. A little piece of Scotland coming your way. Now, there was one of our darkest periods in Scottish history was the clearances.
This was a period in Scotland's history where it was post-Jacobite uprising. The economy of Scotland was not in a great place. That we had formed a union with the United Kingdom, and that was fine. But basically, people north of the border who held land were looking at people south of the border who held land and thinking, well, they're doing better than us. Now, there were very good geographical reasons for that, but they tried to make good the deficit by clearing people off the land and putting sheep on instead. And some of the ways it was done was really not pleasant.
Yeah, but there are plans by Community Lands Scotland to reverse that trend, put people back in the glens. We're going to hear a bit more on that later, but 18th century Sutherland was one of the worst affected areas in. Listening to this, I get really angry. I'm probably not supposed to be partial on this, but I defy anybody to get angry at this. I met up with Jim Hunter, who's been looking into the history, and we'll hear a bit more later about his plans for the future of the glens.
We're in Strathbrora in Sutherland.
And it's an empty landscape, isn't it?
It's an empty landscape, like so much of Sutherland. But Strathbrora was one of the three big straths in the eastern part of Sutherland that were cleared around about 1820. And taking the three straths together, there were between 150 and 200 communities that were eradicated.
That's 1,000 people, possibly plus?
Oh, many more than that. Between the three straths, you're talking several thousand people. And in the space of 2-3 years, all gone.
And looking around us, it must have been quite fertile land.
Well, it was. People here had large numbers of cattle. A lot of the land was also cultivated. And there's a map, a copy of which I have, that dates from the 1790s. It shows the Strathacordona north of here. And when you look at that map, you see not just the townships, you know, maybe half a mile apart, all the way up the Strath. But also what you see are the markings of the fields. They would be in what was called rigs, long, narrow strips, and they grew oats and they grew barley and potatoes and so on. So a cultivated landscape. Now, you go to these places today, like around us here, not a spade turned in it, as it were, for 200 years.
Now, we're standing beside the ruins of many small cottages, but there's also a strange long structure. What's that?
That's the remnants of what was the school for this part of Strathbrora.
It's quite big.
And it is quite big because it had to hold 40, 50, 60 children. So yes, you can imagine that there was a flourishing community. And not just the school was a large building, what the houses are substantial as well. By the standards of that time, the people here were by no means poverty stricken.
How brutal were the evictions? Because it happened very, very quickly.
Oh, it happened very quickly. In the townships around here, there were two townships. There was one a little bit further up called Askelmore and the one nearer here called Askelbeg, and they're separated by a burn. And the burn's called Alt y Fulan, which means mill stream in effect, because there was a mill here as well to mill the grain. And all of that was just swept away. In the case of Askelmore, in the space of 2 days at the beginning of 1821, in May 1821.
Where did they go?
Interestingly enough, the people responsible for this, the Duke and Duchess of Sutherland and their various henchmen, as it were, at that point, about the last thing they wanted was for the people to go away, for a distance. What they were trying to do was move the people out of places like this to put all this land under sheep. That was hugely profitable at the time because there was such a demand for wool. Because, you know, today we think of hill sheep farming and the cash crop is lambs. But in these days, the cash crop was the wool. But they had this idea that you put these people down on the coast, they can no longer be full-time farmers because you're forcing them onto crofts of 3 or 4 acres maximum. And so they have to do something else and they'll make a living. That's the theory anyway, as fishermen. But a lot of the people from around here, because they were relatively well off, they managed to get across the other side of the Atlantic Ocean and settled in Nova Scotia. And when I was looking into the history of all of this, I was in touch with a couple of people in Nova Scotia who are descended from folk who lived in this very vicinity where we are. Not far from where we are here, a little bit further down the Strath, when you're beside Loch Brora, you look across the loch and you see the green fields there that were once the township of Carroll. And it was cleared completely in 1820. That was in June, the last folk left. And in September 1820, the Duchess of Sutherland came up here in her carriage. The road was new then. And looking across the loch, it's about half a mile or so into what were then the ruins of Carroll, because at one stage they'd burned the houses when the folk were removed. They'd stopped doing that because that had proved so controversial in the southern press. So she's writing to her husband that same evening, and she talks about looking across at the township and this sense of melancholy that she felt. And that's kind of extraordinary in a way, because, of course, the ruins, the empty township, the melancholy were all a direct result of something she and her husband had ordered. But it's almost, when she's writing about it, as if it's a kind of act of God. It's something she has no responsibility for. It's an extraordinary insight into just how she herself thought about what she'd accomplished.
Does it make you angry? It makes me angry.
Well, it does make you angry. I think... You know, there's a sense in which writing about history and the past, there's a kind of notion that one should be dispassionate about it and not in any way invest any emotion in this. I've never gone in for that kind of thinking. I think it's important to try and understand what it was like for these people. It's very easy to write about all of this as if it was some sort of inevitable impact of some kind of impersonal set of economic forces or something. But ultimately, it was about orders given by one set of people, and it was about what was experienced by another set of people. And what was experienced by the folk who were being removed was pretty, pretty horrible. And sudden, catastrophic communities snuffed out and eradicated. A lot of suffering, just not far from here. The school teacher who was here was a man called Gordon Ross, and his wife Jessie and their children were turned out. He had to be away in the south. He was looking to get work because, of course, the school was going to close. And he'd thought he'd had a guarantee that his wife and the three children would be kept safe, as it were, until he got back. But they were kicked out of the house. And it was in May 1821. The weather was very cold. There was a bitter wind out of the northeast. There were two wee girls, Elizabeth and Catherine, 5 and 3, and a little baby who was called Roberta. And the kids had whooping cough. And whooping cough, of course, in these days could be a fairly serious illness. And it's possible that what would have happened to Catherine would have happened anyway. But when, about 3 weeks later, she died, Gordon, understandably, her father, writes to the Duke in impassioned terms, you know, really, really angry, and attributes the death of his daughter to the inhuman treatment that she and the rest of the family had suffered on the day that they were evicted. And so, yeah, that's what it was like, and it was not pleasant. And I think it's a responsibility for anyone thinking about that or writing about it to at least have some empathy for people in that position.
Professor Jim Hunter from Community Land Scotland. And the thing about Jim's work is he's gone back to the original source material. He's seen the letters. He's seen the court cases. He's seen the court records, all that kind of thing. This is not just anecdote and hearsay, although that is bad enough. But it just, you say, it's difficult to listen to that and not get really angry.
Well, he made the parallel. It was the Syria of its time. These were refugees streaming down the glens looking for help. Mm-hmm. The ones who could afford it got a boat to different places, and the rest were forced to live off the edge by the cliff. Yeah. Fascinating stuff, but stick with us because these plans are really quite radical.
There is a church not terribly far away from Bonar Bridge. I think it's, off the top of my head, I think it's called Croic. But the church window is actually, and somebody had a diamond ring and they inscribed it. And it says something along the lines of, you know, we are cursed of God. Because at that stage, people who had been moved out of the glens were trying to take shelter in the church graveyard before they moved further down into the coast. Just extraordinary.
A pretty dark period.
Right, let's continue on a much brighter note, on a much happier note altogether. Let's continue with my wildlife safari with keeper Andy Malcolm. We were on Invermark Estate, which is up Glen-esk. Wasn't the best of days. It really wasn't the best of days. But Andy and I pressed on in his trusty, and for trusty, read rusty, Land Rover.
This is the Queen's Well. It's a well-known landmark. Anybody coming up here to walk out up to the top of Mount Keen comes past this.
Now, this is an interesting structure, because essentially what you've got is six arms coming up. It's effectively like, almost like a Norman arch shape. There's a cross on top of that, and then there's this structure. And obviously, where we're standing at the moment, it must have been surrounded by white quartz chips.
It was originally called White's Well, but in Queen Victoria's time, she used to do an awful lot of trailing about, and you know, the story goes that she came over here with her entourage, took a drink of the waters, and ever since it's been known as the Queen's Well. What it doesn't say anywhere is that the water that comes up in the well here originates on the other side of the glen. It comes from that hillside, and the water here passes underneath the river and wells up here.
And there is an obvious upwelling here, because there's essentially two concentric circles. The inner one is slightly higher, and you can see the water sort of, it's almost like sort of belling out and running down that little groove to one side.
It's been beautifully made. It's a nice thing, and the water's gorgeous.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Let's see if I can step in here without falling over. It's almost a sweet water, that.
It's amazing how different the water can be in some places. There are some burns out the hill that they run black, you know, they come out of peat and they're coloured, but there's some burns, peaty water in it, and the stones are still clean, and then there's others, the stones are all black, and I don't know whether that's because the stones are originally black or whether it's from coloration of the water. And there's some burns that you can always have a drink from, and then there's others that you just don't bother with.
Coming up to a ford in the river here, but do you know that's a goer?
I'm pretty sure we can get across, but it's getting back is going to be the issue. So this is
seriously.
It's yeah. I mean, sort of the snow's melting all the time, and we're sort of getting close to the top of the wheel arches. It's not prudent. We would get across here. I know this ford is pretty flat from here, but it's the getting back that I'm concerned about. Yeah. It's a great shame, because the other side of the river is where we need to be to sort of to do the trip that I was planning.
Well, I mean, you can hear. I mean, the river's quite full. I've never seen anybody do this with a Land Rover before. Just kind of stick its nose in and say, "How deep is this?"
Yeah, well, you have to know the ford. You wouldn't do it with a strange ford. The danger is if there was a big hole there, you know, you'd sort of lose the front end of the boat into the river, and then you'd be stuck. Yeah. And it wouldn't be the first time on this place that somebody had drowned a Land Rover, and it's quite an expensive mistake to make.
Yeah. Well, discretion being the better part of valour.
Yeah, the big question is what we're going to do now. I think it's only going to be going up today, and it's going to be even warmer tomorrow, so this will be a raging torrent tomorrow, if it isn't already.
There's obviously been a tremendous amount of water come down the glen this winter.
Yes, yeah. There's also a tremendous amount of water still sitting on the hill. I would say we've probably got 30% snow cover on most of the high ground, most of the ground over sort of 2,000 feet. Yeah. Still a lot of snow up there. If you think how many tons there are in just one wreath of snow, that's a lot of water.
Just as we've been sort of bumping along beside the river here, you know, there have been grouse in and amongst the heather. Occasionally you catch this, you know, really scarlet flash, you know, above the eye. This thing flies past and things. There's a lot of birds higher up than this. What effect is it likely to have on breeding success? Because it's been a real late... I mean, it's been a long-running winter and a very late spring.
We reckon that a hard winter isn't too bad for the birds. By hard, if we get snow and we get ice and we get frosts, we actually reckon it's a good thing. The frosts hopefully sort of kill some of the bugs in the ground, you know, the parasitic worms and the ticks and the likes. It appears that that doesn't do the grouse much in the way of harm. What can affect them is if they can't actually get nesting for snow. I last had that about 2011, that we had so much snow that there was big areas of the state that the grouse couldn't get to the heather to nest.
And as you've said, that's your harvest.
That's our harvest. That is the lifeblood of this estate.
gamekeeper Andy Malcolm. And coming up shortly, we go in search of an animal that had just awoken from his winter hibernation. Beautiful weasel.
I'm quite envious of this because I've never seen one of them. Mm-hmm. I've been told where they are, I've been pointed out where they are, I've never seen one. And that's one of the tick list things to do.
Stick with the Scotland Outdoors podcast and you will find out. Now, we have featured the work of Trees for Life many times over the years. Essentially, they're an organisation which is trying to show how a reforestation of Scotland could look, but they face the problem how to get trees planted successfully where trees haven't been for donkey's years.
And that's the main problem, that for hundreds of years there haven't been trees there. They should be there, but they've been kept... Well, back to grouse again, and we kept in heather. But this week they unveiled a secret weapon in the battle to get trees established in upland Scotland. And I joined Doug Gilbert. He's the conservation manager in Invermorrison. Hear a bit more.
If you do it the natural way, you know, they're absolutely fine at getting on with it themselves. If you want to plant a tree artificially, then it becomes a little more complicated.
Because they fight you all the way, don't they?
And because the soils that we're dealing with in most cases have been depleted over there. Over the many years that they've had no tree cover.
Because you're doing it on a big scale.
We're doing, yeah, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of trees most years.
So what kind of failure rate do you get? Because, I mean, you have some successes and some that struggle.
Yeah, it varies depending on the species and whether broadleafs and conifers are different. Generally, our planting is pretty good. We get, you know, 70-80% success rate, so 20-30%. Failure.
Okay, so you know, here we are up at Invermorrison. You're digging a hole in the ground. What trees are you planting and what do you put in with them up until now?
Well, all the trees that we plant are native. A lot of them we collect the seed locally for them, so they're Dundregan trees, and that includes birch, the two common species, downy and silver, but also oak, rowan, aspen, alder, hazel, all sorts of things. Usually what we do is we have to treat the ground in some way. So we use this technique called mounding, which is basically turning the soil upside down, just as you would in a garden to turn the soil over. And that creates a little gap in the vegetation, a bit of drainage and access to the mineral soil. So then the tree's got a good start in life. But we also usually have to put in some level of fertiliser because the soils here have been completely depleted of especially phosphate, but also nitrogens.
Is that just from water or the fact that the trees have been removed decades ago?
It's mostly from water. It rains an awful lot in Glenmorrison. So that constant filtering of the soil horizons has meant all the goodness has basically been washed down into the subsoil or away entirely, so they're just not there anymore.
It's a complex ecosystem.
It is, and it's more complex than you could ever imagine. You look in a forest like we've got at Dundregan, and yes, you see lots of different tree species, but underneath your feet, there's an incredible complex web of communication and nutrient transport going on that we're only just beginning to, you know, get a handle on and understand. And that's a combination between the trees and fungus.
Because there's a lot of mutual back scratching goes on.
Absolutely. Symbiosis, mutuality, and the fungus is actually accessing nutrients in the soil that the tree can't do itself just because of the fungus's amazing ability to harvest particularly nutrients and minerals. And the tree is providing sugars to the fungus and feeding it that way. So it's very mutually beneficial.
So you've got that lovely forest harmony going on in the natural state, but yeah, you haven't got that on your bare hillside. But you've come up with a clever plan.
Well, we're doing a bit of a trial. We've known about this association for over a century now, so that element of it is not new. But we've had mushrooms and toadstools gathered at Dundregan that are native to here, obviously, and obviously like our soils and conditions. And we've created, through help from Chaos Fungorum, which is the name of the company that's helped us with this, and they've produced this inoculum. It's like a charcoal-based inoculum.
Okay, we'll have a wee look.
Yeah, there you go.
You've got a tub of it there. So you've got your own mix on it.
Yep.
Dundregan mix.
For natural root growth, it says. So there
you go. Looks like a bucket full of charcoal. I was expecting a whole bucket of spores.
Yes, I was too, and I was quite surprised at that.
Did you send it back?
So, obviously, the spores are teeny-meeny, and you can't see them. So they're obviously in there. The charcoal really is just an inert carrier kind of thing.
Them.
Yeah.
So is it just a couple of species of fungi you've got in there?
No, 59 varieties, even more than Mr. Hines.
Wow, that's a fair old cocktail, isn't it?
It is. You can get this kind of material commercially, but they generally only have three or four species of fungus.
Why so many then? Just is it more the better?
More the better. Gives everything a better chance, we hope. You know, more potential for better associations.
Are you confident? Have you trialled it before?
No, we haven't. We've tried it with leaf litter, which was a slightly disappointing result. We're kind of hopeful, yeah. We'll see what the results are. And we'll be monitoring the tree growth and establishment over the next 2 or 3 years.
But it's a potential. I mean, if they've only got three or four in the commercial one, and you've got 59, there's a fair old financial spin-off there. Fungi from Scotland.
Yes, well, possible. The key thing for us is this is from the local area, so it's, you know, a fungal association that.
Yeah, but
is,
it's something you could scale up to other forests in Scotland.
It's possible, yeah. It takes a fair bit of doing to get to gather the mushrooms in the first place and to get the spore material that you need to make the inoculum.
What is the ultimate aim here? You know, we're looking at the small picture, but the big picture, what's the aim?
Well, the aim is to create a new and vibrant forest that actually has all the ecological bits to it that it needs to be a self-sustaining ecosystem. So we're doing the small stuff, which we know is hugely important for the existing native woodland, is one step towards that.
Doug Gilbert of Trees for Life at Dundregan near Invermorriston, and just while that was playing, we were saying to each other, we didn't set out to do a programme entirely about grouse moors this week, but that's
the way it's happened.
Kind of the way it's fallen out.
We tend to start off independently at the start of the week and then regroup on a Friday, and we seem to have covered a certain theme running through the whole programme.
Anyway, you are listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast.
Yeah, keep your emails and messages coming in. Honestly, cheers us up and gives us something to talk about. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And that's what Duncan Grant did.
Yeah, he says, I've landed a cracking temporary job with a European camping operator as the driver on a small team setting up the tents on the sites ready for the summer. Started off early March in the Black Forest, then into the Swiss Alps, then the Jura Mountains in France, and now back in the French Alps. Later this week, back to Swiss Alps, and then home to Strathspey mid-May. He says, I get the podcast every week and enjoy it as I wander around these still-closed campsites in the early mornings, listening to the birds. I really enjoyed the piece in Glenfeshey, as that's near home. Wildlife highlights so far, an otter in the Franche-Comté, and a golden eagle above Lake Annecy. That's not a bad job.
That's a good job, Duncan, you've got yourself there.
Yeah.
Getting round all these beautiful places before the campers arrive.
Yeah. And taking the Scotland Outdoors podcast with you. Speaking of which, we're not just doing one a week anymore.
No.
Well, not every week, but...
Well, we're going to try and do two a week now. We've got a midweek one. Goes out on a Wednesday. Last week we did a 90-minute special from Yosemite about the John Muir anniversary, and go to the BBC Radio Scotland website, look for Scotland Outdoors podcast. You've got one this week.
Yeah, well, basically it went out last Wednesday. We did a half-hour interview with a lady called Lorraine Lucia, who's a hill sheep farmer down in Dumfries and Galloway. There's a longer version of that available in the podcast. They've been facing really difficult times, but it's just astonishing the resilience and the talent they have.
And we've changed the way we run this now because the podcasts are going to stay up forevermore, so they used to fall off the edge after 3 or 4 weeks. We're going to build up a whole back catalogue. If you've got any podcasts you think you would like to hear again, get in touch and we'll stick them back up again. But exciting times for us, and if you do like them, give us a rating, recommend it,
subscribe. Apparently subscription is a good thing, we've discovered.
It doesn't cost any money, by the way. That subscription puts folk off an awful lot of time. It doesn't cost any money.
What it means is we kind of go up the ratings thing. Why is that important? Well, to be honest, it won't bring another penny into our pockets, but what it will do is bring it to the attention of other people who might enjoy it, and we are keen on doing that. You know, if you know somebody that might enjoy it, tell them about it. Now, earlier we heard from Professor Jim Hunter on some of the history behind the clearances of the Highlands.
Yeah, and Community Lands Scotland are a body that want to reverse that process, get folk back into the straths and the glens that were cleared of people by, well, certain aristocracy. And he outlined his thinking behind the radical proposal.
Well, the idea is simply that in at least some of the localities like this, that people should be able to move back in again. And I think that most fundamentally and initially requires people and the authorities to start thinking about localities like this in a different sort of way. Today they tend to be categorised as wild land. What we see around us here, all this emptiness, is somehow thought to be natural almost. And yet it isn't, and it's historically a fairly recent creation. People lived in Strathbrora here for 5,000 years. So for 50 centuries there were people here, and for the last two there have been no people here. So we've got to begin to open our minds to the possibility that what we see here is not natural, it's not the way it ought to be, it's absolutely the opposite of that, and that it would be very good if in some localities like this anyway people were able again to settle here.
So what would be the mechanics of that? Because you've been in the process of drawing up a map of areas that could be repopulated.
Well, the key to it is housing, and of course in a sense that's the key to people living in rural areas generally in Scotland. And somehow or another there has to be a mechanism found that makes housing, new housing in localities like this, affordable. Now, I grew up in the West Highlands and in the north part of Argyll. And I go to places like that today and there are literally millions of acres in these localities that are put to no very productive purpose. And yet, to buy a few square yards for a house, you might have to pay something like £100,000 or even more. Now, that is completely and utterly crazy. There is no way that that piece of land is in any way realistically worth that. And so somehow we've got to break out of that cycle. We've also got to, I think, get planners and others to begin to think about this a little bit more imaginatively, whereby they no longer assume that the only place you can put a new house is a place where there already are houses. And what we're talking about is creating essentially new settlements, new communities, new villages in places where currently there is nothing at all.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have that problem here because you could easily argue these are old structures. You could put houses back there.
Well, of course you could, yes. And it's, you know, it's a very attractive place. It's not exactly the back of beyond.
Because we're only 5 miles from...
We're 5 miles from the A9, the main road north. There's a railway about the same distance away and a railway station. So we're not talking about the middle of the wilderness, so to speak. And it's a very attractive area, which, of course, is why it was so thickly populated for such a long time. And it doesn't necessarily follow that people here would be working the land. I don't think anyone's thinking about a reversion to what was here 200 years ago. It's simply to create the possibility that folk could live in a place like this. I think if there was housing available, there would be no lack of takers for it.
So would it be a compulsory purchase if the estate didn't want to sell the land or give, even better, give the land?
Well, I don't think anyone's quite got to that stage yet in thinking about whether there should be compulsory purchase or not. But, you know, we've been here before in the sense that... about 100 years ago now, especially in the years just after the First World War, there were quite a lot of localities, not so much in this part of the Highlands, but on the West Coast and in the Hebrides, taken over by the governments of that time. And these were places where sheep farms had been created and there had been clearances just like around here. And at the time, of course, there was a huge demand from young men, particularly just back from the First World War, for crofts. They'd been promised land when they joined the army in the first place. And some of them, of course, just took the land anyway. But under that sort of pressure, the government acquired a lot of land, created a lot of new crofts. So there are precedents for doing this. And the government then had powers of compulsory purchase. And in fact, the legislation, it was called the Land Settlement Act of 1919. The legislation that allowed the government to do that is actually still available. So there are precedents for doing it. As I say, I don't know that necessarily what we're talking about is creating new crofts and the like. It's much more to do with creating opportunities simply for folk to live here. If people want to farm the land or if they want to get involved in woodland or other forms of land management, so be it. But I think the main attraction would just be to begin to recreate communities in places where there are none.
It's quite exciting though, isn't it? You could transform. Well, I mean, I keep beating on about it. This is an empty landscape that's not terribly productive. You can really rewrite the map.
Oh, you could do, yes. And if you think about, you know, take Sutherland, for example. The average population density in England today is 413 people per square kilometre. In Scotland, I think it's around 68 people per square kilometre across the country as a whole. In Sutherland, it's two people per square kilometre. So we're talking about a place where there's virtually nobody. And in fact, you know, the folk who do live in Sutherland are mostly on the coastal fringe because of the clearances. So this vast area in the interior is empty. So yes, there's an opportunity to transform all of that. And I think, you know, folks say, well, what would they do? But of course, what do people do anywhere? It always occurred to me that if you were to look way back in the past at a tract of tidal swampland, for the most part, beside a river estuary, you might have thought, well, there's not much future for this place, and today it's the City of London. So there's absolutely no saying what can be done if with a bit of imagination and with people prepared to give it a go.
Professor Jim Hunter of Community Land Scotland. And it's interesting, there is a momentum building here, because last week I was talking to a gentleman from the James Hutton Institute who was saying they've been looking at SPAs, sparsely populated areas, and that in order just to keep the status quo, not to improve it, not to bring more people back in, they would need to move 1,000 people back into these areas every year and keep them there, which is a great idea, but what do they do?
Yeah, well, there's telecrofting. If you get a decent internet signal, which vast chunk of the Highlands does have now.
Yeah.
Not in our part of Aberdeenshire, but, you know, we're not bitter. And well, certainly the one that Jim and I were on, it's a beautiful glen. It's 5 miles from the nearest train station and 5 miles from the nearest town. So, you know, it could be done, and it's stunningly beautiful. The bit we were at, it's a lovely wee outcrop of green grass, some nice rocks, big rocky landscape. Couple of scrubby trees, Caledonian pine, beautiful wee loch, beach, proper beach, really, you know that granite sand you get?
Oh, yeah.
It's just lovely. It's beautiful. I would die to live there. Uh-huh. And the fact that...
Well, not much point in doing that, really, is
it? Well, not a point. The point that Jim was making is we have to make it affordable and accessible for everybody. It's all very well building a beautiful house in that landscape. You and I couldn't afford to do it at the moment, but you could make it more affordable. It's really quite exciting stuff. And the thing that excites me about the podcast is there will be people listening around the world who are descendants of people who are cleared out that glen. And we'd certainly like to hear from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
There is a spectacular monument just outside Helmsdale, you know, of a crofter and his wife and children, etc. And it's just, it's beautifully, it really captures the sense of anguish.
I thought you were going to say some beautiful sculpture of the Earl of Sutherland.
Well, there is that one too. Interesting, there is the Duke and Duchess of Sutherland that we were talking about. There is a statue above Golspie, and it's called the Manny locally, you know, the Manny. And I went up to take a look at it quite recently, and the bottom of it, the plinth, which stands about 12 feet high, it's an enormous statue, is actually shielded in metal gridding now to stop people trying to vandalise it. That's the level of feeling.
It's not vandalism.
Vandalism if you're destroying a work of art.
Well, yeah, but people, many people, not everybody, it's controversial, but a lot of people would like to see that statue go.
It would be an interesting manoeuvre, put it that way. Let's go back to Invermark Estate up Glen Esk. I was out on a wildlife safari in the company of gamekeeper Andy Malcolm. To be honest, we hadn't really seen much in the way of wildlife because it was pretty damp. It was kind of blowing a hoolie at the same time, and we thought, well, we can give it a go. We can only try.
I'm going quite cautiously, but I shouldn't think that's necessary because it's been a cold day up till now. If there is a snake out, I imagine it'd be pretty torpid. I've found over the years this is the very best sort of place to spot an adder. See where you've got this rickle of stones with the moss growing over it. The snakes can get sort of deep down inside the stones when it's cold, and they come out and they sun themselves on these little patches of moss. It's maybe just not warm enough for them yet. We're into a last-ditch attempt here. No pun intended, but when I say ditch, we're looking down into this dry riverbed here. It's going to be the warmest spot. Anything down there would be out of the wind. As I say, the day is warming up. It's been overcast and it's been dreich all morning, and maybe the temperatures hasn't come up enough yet.
Oh, there we go. It's all curled up. It's conscious of us.
Yes, I know we're here. A lot of people come here expecting, well, wanting to see sort of eagles and deer and stuff like that, but this is one of the little specialities of this glen. I don't know another place like it for adders on a warm spring day. I can see quite literally dozens of them.
Yeah. It's scenting the air in front of us, and perversely, it's actually heading towards us. It would be, I don't know, maybe about 40 centimetres long. Actually much darker than ones I've seen before.
Yeah, that's a female.
All right.
Yeah, the males are much lighter coloured. They're almost a slate blue and, uh-huh. and black. But that one, it won't be long out of hibernation. It's been so cold here for so long. You can see it's very torpid. It's moving very slowly. Later on, when it's warmer, you wouldn't be able to sort of draw alongside that without it sort of clearing off.
It's kind of just retreated underneath the small pile of rocks.
Yes, aye. This small pile of rocks that makes up the road, and every few years, you can see by the debris on the fence here, mm-hmm. This whole area gets flooded, and I think it knocks the population right back. Yeah. We haven't had that since the big floods, was that?
Was it? This is 18, so it would have been January 16.
Yeah, that could be right, yeah. Yeah, so, whatever, the population has started to come back, but for a long time I didn't see, hardly saw any snakes here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they are undoubtedly venomous, but, you know, they're much more concerned about getting out of your way than anything else.
Yeah, that's right. I've known a few people bitten over the years, and every last one of them was messing with them, you know, trying to pick them up, you know.
Yeah. We've driven up, right up onto the sort of lower slopes of Mount Keen. And we've stopped the Land Rover because there's a small herd of deer just moving across the face. And I thought what I was looking at was the tails of the deer heading off in the opposite direction, and then realised that red deer tails, the scuts, aren't that white. And it's mountain hares. Dozens and dozens of mountain hares.
That's right. We have a lot of mountain hares here. The numbers have fluctuated a lot in recent years. But at this time of year, they are so obvious. You know, they're still pure white. You've got them against the black ground. And this is one of the problems that we can have when we're trying to stalk deer. If you're trying to stalk deer on black ground and you have these white hares, the white hares are hiding in amongst the peat hags and in the heather. And you don't see them until you're on top of them. You send them bolting off. And if the deer see hares running like that, they know that there's danger around and they just take to their heels. So the more hares you have, the more difficult it can be to stalk your deer.
I accept the fact that's professionally inconvenient, but are the hares not meant to be here?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm a great fan of having all the variety of wildlife on the hill. It can be frustrating, especially if you've put a lot of hours in trying to get close to your deer. You know, very often it's the very last stages of the stalk that this happens. Mm. It can undo, you know, a lot of hours of work and a lot of climbing and so on. But I wouldn't have it any other way. In the past, when we've had massive hare numbers, it's been part of our responsibility to control the hare numbers. And when you do that, you know, you organise these hare days with, you know, all the keepers from surrounding estates. And in the heydays I saw, we were killing massive amounts of hares, and there were still loads left.
Define massive amounts. How many?
I've seen over 1,000 hares shot in a day. Yeah.
See, that's the kind of footage that turned up recently on the news, and it will have been shocking to a lot of people. The argument, obviously, would be, why can't you just let nature balance out the number of hares?
Well, you can do, but all the time you're waiting for nature to balance out the hares. A, we're not getting our deer culls. B, the hares are sort of creating a lot of grazing pressure, areas where there might not have been so much pressure, mm-hmm. stopping trees regenerating and so on. But the other thing is if you...
Yeah, but trees aren't regenerating here anyway, Andy.
Well, why do you think they're not regenerating?
There'd be a whole variety of reasons. Deer pressure could be part of it.
Deer pressure, but hares as well.
Do you get sheep up here at all?
No, not up here.
Not up here, no. Okay.
But you look through the peat hags round about here, you'll find plenty of tree roots.
That's just extraordinary. I only once, I think, in my life, and it was in the Braes of Glenlivet, Have I seen more mountain hares on a hillside than that? But, I mean, literally, looking across, once you get your eye in, you just see them dotted all the way throughout the heather. And they were almost like playing Chase Me Charlie going up the hill. There was a whole herd of them.
It was the deer that got the hares moving.
Yeah.
But you can see what happens is the hares put this sprint on, uh-huh. and it's very, very obvious, even from a distance away. Uh-huh. But the hare numbers you're seeing here, you know, I'm hazarding, I guess, that would be a tenth of what we were seeing when we had, you know, sort of these massive hare shoots. You can hardly imagine the number of hares that we had on the hill. Mm. And we didn't have to cover a big area to be shooting 1,000 hares, you know, sort of, it would be just one ridge worth, you know, maybe sort of a couple of miles long. Yeah.
Red grouse.
He's looking rather splendid.
Isn't he just?
We must be in his territory.
Yeah, he just picked up there, almost a sort of, you know, did a triangular flight, peaked, came back down, landed on the knoll there, and even from, what is it, about 20 metres away, just that scarlet flash above his eye. As you say, must be in his territory.
Must be. We'll move on, leave him in peace.
Keeper Andy Malcolm and red grouse, mountain hares and adders.
So how close did you get?
About the same distance as away from you.
Wow.
I mean, you could have gone closer. It really was quite torpid. I mean, it was, frankly, just half a week.
Safe enough to pick up?
No, absolutely. Do not pick them up. That's just asking for trouble. You know, they're unlikely to be lethal, but it will kind of spoil your day. Just don't do it.
I'll just get it down to do that in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Take that off.
First time I saw one, actually, was going up the side of... It was on the West Highland Way. It was going up the side of Loch Lomond. And there was a whole bunch of Japanese hikers standing round something and kind of poking it gently with a stick. Yeah, I said, please don't do that. Just go away. Leave it.
The cobra bites.
No, I said, let's leave it in peace. Anyway.
Yeah, birdsong. We'd pick a big birdsong in this programme. Mm-hmm. We get up in the morning and it makes you smile. You get a blackbird or a wren. Mm-hmm. Full tilt. It is just brilliant. But the nice folk up at Glen Tanner Estate in Deeside are offering to teach you how to recognise birdsong. But they're also issuing a warning about something dangerous deep in the woods. Here's head ranger Eric Baird.
We're underneath some pine trees and you can probably hear the crunch of the pine cones below us. And basically we're just a few metres away from the car park. So you don't actually have to go very far in Glen Tanner to actually experience contact nature.
It is kind of instant. In some ways you feel slightly guilty because it's so close to the car park, but it's instant, isn't it?
Well, I guess it is, as soon as you get out of your car, but you do have to get out of your car, okay?
Well, yeah, that's fair enough. We are out of the car. We are walking along a slight path. Beautiful smell. We've got these ancient Caledonian pines around us. Bit of wind in the trees, a bit of heat in the sun. It's a great place to be.
Yeah, you mentioned the sun, and you can see the sort of spring is really starting to happen here. I mean, just below us, we've got some blaberry that's just starting to come into leaf, and that's a really important plant in these parts because it's a key food plant for birds like capercaillie, for example.
Come on to capercaillie in a minute, but birdsong, suddenly it goes from very little, very thin, just the occasional pheasant, to it's really cranking up now to be quite an impressive thing to do in the countryside.
Yeah, it's a really great time of the year to actually listen out for them because there's few leaves on the trees. Consequently, sound travels a lot faster, further. And also what you can do is you can actually identify the bird with the song. You know, so rather than just trying to listen to something, you can see the bird that's actually making the sound.
Yeah, I've just seen a coal tit just floating away from me.
Yeah, just up there in the pine there. Yes, yeah, yeah.
What else can we hear?
Okay.
This isn't dawn chorus, obviously. No, this is the middle of the day.
It's not dawn chorus. We've got lots of little songbirds here. Why don't we walk across into these birches? I can hear some long-tailed tits on the go through there. But there's also a bigger songbird through there as well that you can hear.
Which is the really irritating one? It goes, ee, 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 ee.
Well, one man's irritation is... I mean, sometimes long-tailed tits, they make a bit of a noise in the trees. But also, I mean, other birds, I mean, one of the noisiest ones, of course, is the little wren, you know? Tiny little bird with a huge voice, so to speak.
Beautiful song, though, often confused with a blackbird to a certain extent. Well, yeah. Obviously not by you.
Well, yeah, I mean, although blackbirds, I mean, well, you're going to see them as well, so that's an easy one to spot kind of thing. But also blackbirds have got quite a long, elongated song. I mean, it's really lovely to listen to blackbirds. And there's this thing about them as well. I mean, they almost have their individual songs, so you can recognise your blackbird in your garden kind of thing, and it'll be different to your neighbour's blackbird.
Yeah? Oh, what's that right in front of us?
Okay, what you've got is a little cock chaffinch just down on the ground there, just pecking at some seeds. Yeah, there he goes back up into the pine tree up there.
A couple of wood pigeon.
Yeah.
How easy is it to teach people to recognise birdsong?
Well, I guess probably not like this, by walking through the woods. I think the best way is probably just to sit down somewhere and actually wait till the birds actually come to you. And then, as I say, at this time of the year, it's perfect because the birds are very active, they're very vocal, but at the same time, because there's no leaves on the trees, you can actually see the bird. You see the bird that's making the song. And that's the key thing, is to link the vision with the sound, link the two together.
Do you learn to just recognise it, okay, that's a blackbird? Or do you use rhymes and aids to your memory to figure out what the song is?
No, actually, basically, you just link it. You just see the bird and see its behaviour as well, because all the birds behave. And sometimes what you'll just see is a movement out of the corner of your eye, and that will immediately trigger the kind of bird that you're going to be looking for, and then you might hear the song at some point. And, of course, once you've made that link, that connection with the visual movement to the actual sound, then whichever comes first, you'll have the bird.
It's quite daunting, because there's a big array of songs out there. But you've got a seminar coming up in a few weeks to help people through this.
Yes, and the idea of that is we'll actually take people out into the woods and we'll just spend time with an expert, and we'll actually get people just to open up to the birds. I mean, that's the main thing. I mean, when you first go into the woods, there's quite a lot of... your senses are almost getting overloaded with the sights, the sounds, the smells, the feel of the wind on the back of your face, that kind of thing, you know? So you really have to take some time, calm down quite a bit, and let the sounds actually come to you, and then start to isolate particular sounds.
Now, this is presumably going to be quite popular. You got the book for this?
Yes, we'd like people to get in touch with us, and the important reason for that is it's really important that everybody gets full attention.
The reason I'm here, since I'm going off on a tangent in birdsong, is because you've shut off one of your paths. Why is that?
Yes, shut off, that sounds quite abrupt, doesn't it?
What
we've done is we've asked people not to use a particular track, and the reason for that is that we've got a capercaillie there, a male capercaillie, a cock capercaillie, and he's looking for a mate, and he's pretty active on that track, and there's always the chance that he might either mistake you for a potential mate, or he might mistake you for a potential rival, and the encounter would probably be not good for the bird, and probably not good for yourself, and definitely not good if you had a dog with you, for example. So the best thing to do is really to close that path off temporarily and make sure we've got other routes that people can use.
Well, they're not used to people, though. Could you actually put them off mating for a whole season?
Well, it's not so much that you would put them off the mating, but you would actually cause an encounter, and they'd use up an amazing amount of energy, probably trying to chase you.
And they can give you a real doing. I've certainly had an encounter with a capercaillie where it drew blood.
Yeah, they're certainly capable of that. I mean, if you see their beak, it's quite big and it's got almost a scissor action, because their main food plant is actually the Scots pine. Now, I don't know if you've tried to actually eat any raw Scots pine needles, but it's not an easy munch kind of thing, you know. So their jaws are certainly designed for cutting through Scots pine needles, twigs almost, you know.
And you've had some people actually come off worst.
Well, the first knowledge I had of this particular bird was a gentleman, middle-aged guy, came to the visitor centre with a mountain bike, shorts on, and his lower leg covered in wheels, blood flowing. I assumed he'd come off his bike or had an accident, something like that, you know. But in fact, his response was, he's just had the scariest experience of his life. Now, this is a middle-aged guy. And I thought, okay, what's happened? Attacked by a bird. And this was the capercaillie, this male capercaillie. He'd gone into its territory, it had defended its territory, and saw him off, basically. And presumably, he wasn't fast enough, you know. So at that point, we decided that we really did need to close this path down, as much for the safety of the visitor as for the bird itself.
Eric Baird, head ranger at Glentanna near Aboyne. I'm not sure whether that bird was territorial or whether just aesthetically sensitive, because middle-aged men in shorts deserve to be attacked by capercaillie, in my mind.
I can see the point.
This is the middle-aged man. Middle-aged man.
Wearing shorts.
Yes, leaving middle-aged man wearing shorts. It must be a terrifying thing seeing this thing coming at you.
Uh-huh.
I've certainly been attacked by one. I wasn't wearing shorts. It was in winter. And it was...
Well, you went for your microphone, didn't you?
I went for my microphone. Well, what had happened, we were filming for a programme called Landward that we work on as well. And we'd filmed the bird, and the sound guy said, I'm pretty, I couldn't get a decent shot of the sound because I'm too far away. I said, well, go and get closer. He said, I'm not going closer. So I said, I'll do it.
Like
so there I was. I got within, you know, the microphone was 9 inches away. I was getting fantastic sound. And then it just grabbed the microphone, pulled the windshield off it, and locked onto my upper arm. Went through the wax jacket, a fleece, and a T-shirt, and thermals, and just clamped on. Mm-hmm. And they've still got some wonderful footage of me trying to club this capercaillie with a microphone. I'm going to be honest about it. Anyway, the capercaillie was fine.
Uh-huh. Tell me, when this happened, when this thing was latched onto your arm, etc., were you making manly noises?
Oh, no,
desist and go away? Or were you just running around in circles, shrieking?
Squeaking.
Well, let's go back to Invermark Estate, where nothing that dramatic actually happened. I was out with Andy Malcolm, who's a local keeper. He takes these wildlife tours out, etc. Really interesting seeing the countryside from a keeper's perspective. And also seeing things that, frankly, I didn't know was there. Like, for example, this wee loch.
This is a very important spawning tributary for Atlantic salmon. And the danger was that the riverbanks were eroding and silting up the reds, the gravel beds where the salmon spawn. So there was measures taken to reduce this erosion. One was to put up electric fences to keep the sheep out of the riverbanks to stop them rubbing on the riverbanks. There was also trees planted on the bends of rivers, again, to try and prevent the erosion. But there was also a man came up with a big digger, and you can see places where he harvested the rocks from the scree slopes round about, and he placed these big rocks as reinforcement to the bends of the rivers. And they've grown in beautifully, and a lot of people wouldn't realise it had been done by the hand of man.
The planting of trees was not a huge success.
No, the ones that did manage to grow, they would stick their heads out the top of the tubes, and I mean, this is just one massive wind tunnel. Even these young, sort of flexible saplings would just get snapped off just at the top of the tube, so hardly any of them survived.
Where are we going?
We're going to go up the side of the valley here a little bit, just so we can look across. There's an interesting little loch that we can look across to. Normally, I would walk across to it and sneak up and get a close look, but we really are limited with where we can go today.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
you said there was a loch, and I had no idea there was a loch there, I must confess. It's not that you stop and turn around. Oh, there's a loch.
There's a loch, yes. Unfortunately, it's rather a long way away, which is why I brought the telescope. Uh-huh. We'll see if there's anything on it. Just out of interest, you can see there's another wee loch out to the side of it. And that's where we used to curl.
Really?
That's where we used to do our outdoor curling. Uh-huh. You can see that this whole quarry, we're sitting quite high up here. It's north-facing, never gets the sun in the winter. That's where we used to get our sort of most regular ice.
See,
plus it's not very deep.
I like the idea of having a bonspiel, but I mean, let's face it, you are what? 10, 12 miles from Edsel here. It's a long way to throw a stone.
Yes, you have to be keen.
But, very keen.
But yes, it was always a great event, you know, to come out here and outdoor curl. So I'm just getting the telescope set up here. My plan is to see if we can see something of interest on the loch. All right, okay, I've got a widgeon right at the back of the wee loch there.
Oh, aye. No, I can see it.
Yeah, it's just, in the distance.
We're looking at something that must be the guts of certainly 600 metres away. And I can actually see it upending itself and feeding just in the shallows. That chestnut head. What I find really satisfying about this is, when, you know, you've been in this landscape for 30 years working as a keeper. You know it quite literally like the back of your hand. I can see it, and I can see things in the landscape, but it's getting your insights on it that really adds value to this for me.
I think it's not just about the wildlife either. I mean, this is a landscape that, you know, I've been working in, you know, sort of day in, day out. And, you know, every pile of rocks has a story behind it, you know, sort of, you know, I can point up here and sort of talk about the time we were walking through here and, you know, sort of a wildcat bolted out of the cairn, or I can talk about the time where, so, you know, somebody sort of left their rifle at the top of the hill by accident and had to climb all the way back up for it, and all this sort of thing. And the stories, well, they're endless, you know, and, you know, we're creating them every day. As we're trapped here, we'd be as well using
trap things.
Yeah, and we'll use it to good effect. We'll sit and have our lunch and let the wildlife come to us.
Egg sandwiches, we've got, that looks good. Ham, tomato and cheese. Okay, right, you're in charge of coffee. You know, even in a day like today, what a cracking place for a picnic. We said a bit of a river and spate, the hills going off to either side. We've got this entire area to ourselves. It's fantastic.
Lovely, isn't it? Quite often get people saying, oh, I do like your office.
Yeah,
but
too.
They forget the fact that the roof leaks. And there's a bit of a draft under the door.
All right. This time of the year, where would the deer be?
Not very far away at all. They've been hemmed into this low ground for weeks on end, so they are heading out. But if we spied carefully the hillsides round about here, I'm sure we'd spot something.
Mm-hmm. That is fine.
A piece always is on the hill.
What is it about eating outside?
This time of year is when we start going around looking for fox dens.
All right, okay.
And if we find a fox den, we stake it out.
Mm-hmm.
The remote places, you know, you don't get a vehicle to. You're not carrying any excess gear with you, so you're just lying out in the heather.
See, when you're lying out in the heather like that, are you preoccupied with the business in hand, or does your mind wander?
You definitely go into sort of a navel gazing mode, you know, sort of contemplating the universe and all that. You're always working in a pair, and the idea is that, you know, if one person's staying awake, the other person gets a chance to get some kip. I virtually never sleep while I'm out there. You always have a lug cocked listening for a grouse tuck in somewhere, and it's a really awesome experience, just sitting watching the stars sliding by and watching satellites. And over the years, I've seen, I won't say everything there is to see, but we've seen comets and we've seen eclipses and satellites. You see them every night. It's a clear night. Northern lights, shooting stars, you name it.
Andy Malcolm, keeper with the soul of a poet. And if you'd like to find out more about Glen Esk Wildlife Safaris, you'll find a link on our website.
Yeah, that's just about it. But I'm going to leave you with a really special soundscape, because I was taking part in the International Dawn Chorus Day, which was organised by RTE. And it's a great concept. They start in Australia, and as the globe revolves, they follow the light, they follow the dawn and the birds that come with that. 18 different broadcasters in three continents taking part in this epic live broadcast. It's an incredible thing. So I thought we'd leave you with a soundscape. We're going to start in Australia, and this is a kookaburra, by the way, and then, you know, it's pretty full on. It slips gently into a really thin, elegant dawn chorus. It's not even a chorus that I recorded. We're in Rantapur in India making a programme about tigers, and I was up at dawn, and it was a really lovely sound, and you get a real contrast because it gets a wall of noise in Bressy in France, and that evolves into a Scottish dawn chorus, and you will hear a peacock, you will hear a wood pigeon. Peacock's mine, by the way, that's why it was in my back garden. It's just lovely, and it just shows the contrast around the world.
That's all we've got time for. Enjoy this soundscape, as globally diverse as we can make it, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening. Ha ha ha!
the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.